The Writer Files, a member of the Podglomerate Network.
I wrote this Buckaroo Banzai Against the World Crime League screenplay and then just put it on the internet for people to read. And I had this amazing response where people thought it was the real script to the movie had leaked. And when is this getting made? And I'm so excited. And then I had this vivid memory of when I started doing Poetry Slam. I went to the National Poetry Slam in Seattle, I think in 2000, maybe 2001, that summer, and went into a comic book shop there, and I saw my Buckaroo Banzai screenplay for sale in this comic book. Yeah. along with all these other screenplays for, you know, like unproduced Alien 3 screenplays, stuff like that. But I couldn't believe it. It was the first time I ever saw anything that I had written for sale in a store.
And welcome back to The Writer Files. As ever, I am your grateful host, Kelton Reed, wishing you pages, patience, and perseverance. Number one New York Times bestselling novelist and screenwriter Ernest Cline spoke to me about what inspired him to become a novelist, the success of Ready Player One, and his love letter to Austin, Texas, the mostly true tall tale, Bridge to Bat City. Ernie is the bestselling author of Ready Player One, Ready Player Two, and Armada, and co-screenwriter of the film adaptation of Ready Player One, directed by Steven Spielberg. His debut middle grade novel, Bridge to Bat City, on sale April 9, 2024, is described as a mostly true tall tale about a recently orphaned girl and her mission to help a family of displaced bats find a new home under the Congress Avenue Bridge in Austin, Texas. Ernie's books have been published in over 50 countries and have spent more than 100 weeks on the New York Times bestsellers list. In the first half of this file, Ernie and I discussed the signposts on the road to becoming a writer, his change of fortune and opinion as a screenwriter, the big idea behind Ready Player One, why 90% of Stephen King's protagonists are school teachers or writers, and a lot more. Stay calm and write on. And don't forget, you can always support this show by heading to writerfiles.fm, where you can also sign up for email updates and other resources for writers. And if you're a fan of The Writer Files, please click follow to automatically see new interviews in your podcatcher as soon as they're published, and drop us a rating or a review on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you tune in to help other writers find us. Yes, we are rolling once again on The Writer Files. I am honored today to be joined by a special guest. We have the internationally best-selling author, screenwriter, poet, Renaissance man, Ernest Cline, is hanging out with us today. Thanks so much for taking the time to do this.
Oh, thanks for having me on.
Yeah, this is a treat to get to pick your brain about all things writing and the writing life. And of course, you've got a new one coming up here soon, which I can't wait to talk about, Bridge to Bat City, which I've been enjoying very much. But yeah, I want to talk about how things are. How's life? Are you still in Austin? Because I understand you're a longtime Austinite, of course.
I am. I moved to Austin in 1996, and I moved away a few times briefly for work, but moved back and have been here steady for like 15 years or so. So it's my favorite city in the world. I just love this weird little town in Texas that the whole world comes to. we just had South by Southwest here, and all these amazing filmmakers and people in the technology world, and also musicians, obviously, always come to Austin. So it's a great place to live if you're a fan of music and movies and culture in general.
Yeah, yeah. Well, you clearly are a student of all these things, and it seems like a great fit for you as a writer, especially kind of as some of that inspiration for your work. And, you know, I understand Austin has changed quite a bit, probably in the time that you've been there. You've seen it kind of become this mecca, this hub.
No, it's when I moved here in 1996, I remember the refrain I kept hearing from locals was, "Welcome to town. Man, it's too bad you missed it." Too bad. It was so awesome, like about 5-6 years ago. But now it's all gone to hell. And that was when all these big technology companies started moving to Austin in the 90s. 3M and Dell Computer kind of rose up. Michael Dell was a UT student who ran that business out of his dorm room and then kind of built this local. So that was part of what changed Austin, is all these big companies coming in, and it stopped being a little college town. And as I heard, somebody told me that it is now one of the 10, like the 10th biggest city in the country.
Wow.
That's how fast it's been growing exponentially, you know, ever since I got here. It's never stopped. So word is out about how great Austin is. So I'm not telling anybody anything they don't know.
Right, right. Well, you have some cool stories I know about South by Southwest, which we can dig into. But yeah, I want to talk about your own superhero origins as a writer, of course, and as a filmmaker. But I found it really interesting going back to kind of your roots, that, of course, you know, you were a screenwriter early on. And also, I'm going to pull a factoid here, a 3-year running Austin Poetry Slam champ.
It's true.
Yeah, it's very cool. These are very cool factoids. But take us back a little bit and talk about those early days before, you know, Ready Player One. And
sure. Yeah. Well, those were all like signposts on my journey to becoming a writer. But even before that, I'd started out wanting to be a comedian, and I thought I wanted to work in radio, and I went to broadcasting school. And I remember growing up, I would just listen to comedy albums, George Carlin and Eddie Murphy, over and over again, and memorize the, you know, way they delivered jokes. And I love making people laugh. And I think that was my first foray into the entertainment world, was trying to be a stand-up comedian. And I did improv comedy, but I found that I was funnier on the page. It was more comfortable. And also I got a peek at the life of what a stand-up comedian is like, going from town to town, like performing the same 50-minute, you know, act over and over again, and seemed like kind of a lonely life. And I'm not a big fan of traveling. So that drove me towards wanting to become a screenwriter, I thought, which a lot of comedians have been doing. And I was a huge fan of movies, like a cinephile. From the time that we got a VCR, I was able to kind of dive into the world of cinema. And once I found out that writing movies was a job, I started to order screenplays from this place. This is before the internet. I would order screenplays from Script City, this place in Los Angeles, where you could order screenplays for your favorite movies. And I remember ordering like The Breakfast Club and Say Anything, and studying the screenplays of all these films. And that's how I learned to be a screenwriter. And the first screenplay that I ever wrote was basically fan fiction. It was a sequel to Buckaroo Banzai. at the end of Adventures of Buckaroo Banzai, Across the Eighth Dimension, there's a sequel promised.
Yeah.
Watch for the next adventure of Buckaroo Banzai. Buckaroo Banzai Against the World Crime League. And I love that weird little movie so much, more than anybody should love anything. I am nuts about Buckaroo Banzai. And I always, every time I watch the movie, I would always imagine that sequel. And so as like a exercise to teach myself screenwriting, I wrote this Buckaroo Banzai Against the World Crime League screenplay, and then just put it on the internet for people to read. And I had this amazing response where people thought it was the real script to the movie had leaked. And when is this getting made? And I'm so excited. And then I had this vivid memory of when I started doing Poetry Slam. I went to the National Poetry Slam in Seattle, I think in 2000, maybe 2001. That summer, and went into a comic book shop there, and I saw my Buckaroo Banzai screenplay for sale in this comic book. Yeah. along with all these other screenplays for, you know, like unproduced Alien 3 screenplays and stuff like that. But I couldn't believe it. It was the first time I ever saw anything that I had written for sale in a store. And so I remember I still have a copy of this screenplay that I wrote. And then later on, I would see it at comic book conventions. It became a thing that like people would print out and sell at conventions. So that was I was like, wow, you know, what would happen if I wrote something original that I actually owned and tried to make it myself. And so, the first attempt to do that was Fanboys, which was my first screenplay that actually ended up getting produced. And that's the craziest story ever. I was really inspired by Rick Linklater and how he made Slacker with, you know, almost no money here in Austin. And also Robert Rodriguez, he wrote this book, Rebel Without a Crew, about how he made El Mariachi for almost no money.
Yeah.
And then Kevin Smith, I think for a lot of people, is like, wow, this guy just works at a video store and a convenience store, and he somehow used that as the set of a movie. I love the Sam Raimi, you know, school of just use what you have, find one location and use what you have and make a movie that way. So that was my plan when I had the idea for Fanboys. Actually, my mother had just passed away from non-Hodgkin's lymphoma, and I was kind of going through grief over that. And one of the ways I was distracting myself from it was this new Star Wars movie was coming out. It was 1998, and the first new Star Wars movie in 17 years. It's hard to imagine now with just the abundance of Star Wars. But when I was a kid, the Return of the Jedi came out in 1983, and then there was no Star Wars for 17 years or 16 years. It was the longest gap ever. So from the time I was, 11 years old until I was 27, I'd been waiting for new Star Wars, and my whole generation had. I think that will stand as the most anticipated movie of all time in the history of cinema. You will never have people all around the world lining up outside of movie theaters to see a movie that they didn't even need to. You could get tickets on opening day. They did it just for the communal experience of sharing, like waiting for this movie. So, and while I was waiting for that movie, I remember thinking, what would happen if, I got sick like my mom and I knew that I was going to die, and not live to see this movie. and it like struck me as this really awful, it was a terrifying idea, but also ridiculous. Like, oh, this is what you want to stay alive for. This is like your, you know, but that's part of what makes life livable, is having something to look forward to. And also art and, cinema that really speaks to you is a powerful thing. And so, of course that was one of the things that I wanted to stay alive for. And I wasn't the only one. There's a whole generation of people, generations, plural, looking forward to that movie. And so when I had that idea, I thought, well, what would I do if I knew I was terminally ill? And I thought, oh, I would have to get my friends together and go on a road trip across the country to Skywalker Ranch, where they make the Star Wars movies in California, and and break in or try to meet George Lucas and make my case and say, you know, I'm dying to see this. Literally, I'm dying to see this movie. You know, would you let me see it? And as soon as I had that idea, I'm like, oh, that is a great idea for a movie. For a road trip movie, for a little indie movie that could mirror a hero's journey with a call to adventure, that could mirror the hero's journey in Star Wars that Luke Skywalker goes on. And the inciting incident is, you know, these group of friends find out one of their number is sick, and that he's not going to live to see this movie they've all been waiting to see, you know, since they were kids. And so they go on this Joseph Campbell hero with a thousand faces kind of themed journey across the country and they stop at like Captain Kirk's birthplace in Riverside, Iowa, to mess with Star Trek fans. All these ideas that I had that I was like, oh, I could make this, you know. And I actually started to try to make this movie before, when it was set in 1998, like a year before. I was going to try to make it and release it before Episode One came out. But there was a film reviewer here in Austin that I, Harry Knowles, who had found it in Cool News, and he read it and posted about the script on his website, because I asked him to do a cameo. And just the premise of the screenplay of Fanboys appearing online created like a buzz around this. I had no money. All I had was this idea and this screenplay that I had written. But suddenly I had producers calling me and asking to read the script. And one of them optioned the screenplay, and it took about, from 1998, it took till about 2006, 2007. But eventually the script got sold and made. But that experience actually of having that screenplay getting sold and made and rewritten and heavily altered, you know, in the process, that's what made me want to become a novelist, because it was so, so torturous. Everything that you could ever not want to happen when your first movie gets made happened to me. First off, the two of the producers of this movie, Fanboys, Harvey Weinstein and Kevin Spacey, were the two big producers of this movie.
Oh, wow.
And in the process of it getting made, it got heavily rewritten by two other writers. It's ended up getting taken away after we finished filming it. I mean, the experience of filming it was amazing. Carrie Fisher is in the movie.
Yeah.
Lando Calrissian is in the movie. Darth Maul makes a cameo. and William Shatner. I am in a scene with William Shatner. I could pick what I wanted my cameo to be. So I picked one of the Star Trek fans that they run into in Las Vegas. So I could get to be in this scene with William Shatner, which was amazing. And he was, so the experience was amazing, but then we finished the movie and it didn't come out. And the director, I didn't hear about this until like after it was already in motion, but the director said, they're taking the movie away from us, from me, and they're going to re-edit it. They're hiring another director, to work on it and, change the ending. And the whole premise of the movie about one of the characters dying of cancer, they decided when they test screened it that was a downer. So they were just going to remove that whole plot line and have the fan. I actually saw a cut of the movie where they just went on the trip for no reason other than they wanted to see it early. So they were just trespassing. And, you know, what it was the 40-year-old virgin came out right while we were in post-production, and it made a ton of money. And Harvey Weinstein thought, oh, I can turn this into... These fanboys are kind of like 40-year-old virgins. I can turn this into that and make a ton of money too. And so that's what they tried to do, was turn my sweet little Star Wars fan film love letter into the 40-year-old virgin. And if you want to see how much this is true, people at home, you can put the poster for fanboys side by side with the poster for the 40-year-old virgin, and you will see that they are identical. It's basically just Steve Carell's head with a Darth Vader helmet on it. It's the same poster. So that experience was like, man, you know, maybe I do not want to be a screenwriter after all, if this is what being a screenwriter is. And in the process of getting your work produced, it gets warped beyond, you know, all recognition. I mean, there's still a lot of me in that movie. And, you know, Dan Fogler's character Hutch was kind of based on me, and he was wearing a Rush t-shirt and only allows Rush to be played in his van. And that was that character's very much me in high school. And those characters around him, the other fanboys, are based on the guys I grew up playing Dungeons and Dragons with and hanging out with. So a lot of me is in that movie, but there's a lot of that movie that makes me cringe. Like the Mantina, there's a lot of gay panic and a lot of things that are just not me that got inserted into that movie by the producers that even the filmmakers, you know, themselves didn't want to do. So that whole process is like, made me rethink it and want to try my hand at fiction and think, what would happen if I could just geek out directly with my audience? What if I could tell the story directly to the reader and not have to go find somebody to give me millions of dollars to produce my story? And so that's what I decided to do. Writing fiction is like directing a movie on paper, right? But you're the one who dresses all the sets, and you perform all the dialogue, and the special effects and the budget are only limited by your mastery of the language and the images you can conjure up with the words. So it was kind of freeing to me, and so I and the idea that I ended up attempting was Ready Player One as my first novel, which was an idea that I knew it could never be a movie. As soon as I had it, I'm like, was the idea of what if Willy Wonka was a video game designer, and what if he held his golden ticket contest inside his greatest creation, which would be the greatest video game of all time, like a future video game that is the one video game to rule them all, where all future video games are compatible, and kind of this is the platform for all future video games and social media. And I was trying to imagine the coolest possible future version of the internet and video games, and the two of those coalescing, and then this Willy Wonka-esque golden ticket style treasure hunt in this sprawling virtual world. And I had that idea in August of 2001. I found my original notes where I wrote down that basic outline. And didn't finish the book and sell it until late 2009, I think early 2010. So it was literally from the time that I had the idea to the time that I finished the manuscript and was ready to try to sell it, was 9 years. And I wasn't writing it nonstop for 9 years. I would write a little bit and then set it aside and get frustrated and wonder if I was even cut out to be a novelist. It's a lot more words. A lot more words than a screenplay. A lot more work. You can't just do exterior, you know, office building night. You need to explain. You need to describe that building, set the scene. It's a lot more work, but also you have total control. Yeah. Like when you write exterior, you know, office building night, that you're leaving that up to a set designer and production designers and other people to imagine that. And that's the power of a movie, is everything gets imagined for you. And your brain doesn't have to do any work. It's all there for your eyes. But it's also why books are better than movies, is because of that. Because when you are reading fiction, the story plays out in the reader's mind's eye, right? And the story and the characters, and it's all perfect because you're the one performing all the dialogue in your head and you're the one dressing all the sets. The reader brings a big chunk of themselves and their imagination to the story. So, which is why when people go see a movie, like, oh, it wasn't as good as the book. It wasn't as good as your imagination when you were reading the book, you know. But not everybody's imagination is as good as everybody else, which is why movies are a powerful thing. It's helpful for some people to have things visually imagined for them. But for a lot of people, especially voracious readers, they prefer to do the imagining themselves, because, you know, you can imagine a character the way that you want, and the dialogue performed in a way that, you would perform it. It's really powerful. So that was Ready Player One. And it took, the birth of my eldest child impending to kind of make me finally finish it. And I'm like, well, man, I'm going to have to get the days of goofing around are over. I'm going to have to get a full-time job and provide for this kid. They're going to need things. And it's either now or never. And, you know, I'd made a little bit of money from Fanboys. I had another screenplay get optioned called Thundercape, but it never got produced. But that was enough money for me to live off of while I tried to finish this novel that I'd been working on off and on for 8 or 9 years. And I was working in technical support and web design and spending all day in front of a computer. So it was hard to go home and get back in front of a computer and write in the evenings. And that all comes across in Ready Player One. There's a lot of a whole sequence of the book where Wade Watts, the main character, is stuck in a cubicle working in a giant corporation doing tech support and wishing he was somewhere else. And so sometimes that was the wisdom I discovered. Sometimes working a job that you don't like just to make ends meet ends up giving you the ammunition and the fodder for your storytelling that you need, you know. You don't realize it at the time.
For sure. Case in point, Help Wanted, recently published by, I guess it was on a show, Adele Waldman, who went undercover, feeling uninspired, went undercover and worked in a big box store.
Oh.
And found all this inspiration working with these interesting characters, kind of like on the night shift.
Oh, and wrote fiction about it or nonfiction?
Yeah, fiction.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
Yeah, for sure.
No, you never know. Like, I think that's, like, I always think of Stephen King would always write his characters are always writers or school teachers, because those are the two jobs that he's ever had, ever. But you would, like, go back, and I think, like, 90% of Stephen King's protagonists are school teachers or writers or both. And it works. And he knows the world of being a high school teacher inside and out. And you need that. You could bring that authenticity of your real world experience to your writing, whatever that is.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah,
I was thinking specifically of Misery for some reason, but
oh yeah. Do you know the crazy story behind Misery?
Thanks so much for joining us for this file. And if you're a fan of the show, simply head over to writerfiles.fm for more. That's writerfiles.fm.